I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Murphy Woodhouse. He's a reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau at Boise State Public Radio. He's researched the impact of fire in Western landscapes. And Peter, we're talking about that big topic today. I think it's such a relevant topic. I think fire touches everybody. I think of seasons in Idaho, and fire season is definitely one of them.
Right. And I also think it's a fairly misunderstood topic as well, and how important fire has been to the ecosystem, not only of the West, but, you know, coming from the Midwest, that's the reason why we had prairies. It was because of fire.
Right. And it's a natural process, right?
Right.
I think we'll dig into that. And of course, it has an impact on humans, especially as if we like to live near wild spaces, you know, recognizing how to properly live with fire.
Right. And it's as simple as you like with our gift shop at the zoo, we've put up a front with a FireWise garden. There's ways to protect your houses in fire prone areas.
I'm guessing a juniper tree right next to it is not the answer.
No, it probably isn't the best answer.
Well, before we dig into that, Peter, you got nature news.
You bet. Leif, we're going to talk about earthquakes and their energy budgets.
Oh, fun.
And an energy budget is basically how energy is released off of a quake. And there are three processes: ground shaking.
Right.
Domino-like fracturing of underground rocks, and heat.
Yes.
And for the first time, we've got some researchers out of MIT who have been able to quantify the complete energy budget of an earthquake.
Well, that's cool.
Right. So they built the really fancy and complex pieces of equipment that they were making mini earthquakes. So they would ground up granite to a fine powder, and then they would add a much finer powder of magnetic particles.
All right.
And so what they would do is they would align the particles in one direction under the same magnetic field. And then they would add pressure to their little tiny mini earthquake. And as soon as that slipped, they were able to measure the energy and the temperature changes coming off of it because of the magnetic particles.
All right.
And what they found is that 10% of our lab-grown quake's energy budget is used to cause the physical shaking.
10%?
10%.
That's it?
Yes, only 10%. And around less than 1% actually goes into breaking of the rock. So when we think about earthquakes,
sure,
you know, it's like, oh my gosh, there's this pressure and a fault line slips and it breaks. And
the thing we feel and see the results of is the shaking and displaced rocks or buildings or whatever.
But on average, around 80% actually goes into heating up the immediate region around the quake's epicenter. And it's a real fast, it's not like it turns into, you know, magma. It's just really fast, and that energy, boom, and it's gone, and, you know, and then it cools right back down. But for the most part, it will liquefy the rocks around it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And the cool part is what they're looking at is if they could kind of get the history of known earthquakes, for instance, how much shaking occurs during an event, then they kind of use that information to calibrate the rest of the energy budgets around that earthquake and can then potentially predict how dangerous or how much energy would be released in the next potential earthquake.
I see. And all of this from a scale model in a lab.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Very cool. Thanks, Peter.
You bet.
Well, today's trivia question deals, of course, with fire. What year did our modern wildlife suppression approach to fire start in the United States? When we get back from the break, we're going to talk about fire, and we'll get an answer to that question and many other things. So stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Murphy Woodhouse. He's a reporter from the Mountain West News Bureau in Boise.
First off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
I always like talking fire. Thanks for the invitation.
Murphy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do? I'm curious how you got doing what it is that you do.
I'm the Mountain West News Bureau reporter at Boise State Public Radio. BSPR is the founding station of the Bureau, but it's a network of a number of stations across the Mountain West. I've got four other reporting colleagues scattered across the West, Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, Nevada, and then we have a number of other stations that take our content and support the effort. We cover the West on a regional basis. The basic idea is, we want someone, driving to work in Boise to be as interested in the story as someone in Albuquerque or Laramie or wherever. Like, we want the stories to kind of have regional impact. And so much of my reporting focuses on wildfire. I think you're hard pressed to think of a phenomenon that has as much regional relevance. I mean, water issues come to mind, things like that. But yeah, I mean, basically every Western state experiences substantial impacts from wildfire. And then I'm from Idaho, grew up in Southeast Idaho here in Pocatello. I'm a hometown boy, very proud of it, but was out of the state for quite some time. I was down in Southern Arizona for a while, and then also in Northern Mexico for a number of years. So when I came back to Idaho in the West, the obvious question was, and that was back in, would have been spring of 23. So I've been back for about 2.5 years. I've been living in Northern Mexico. I've been kind of out of the Western loop for a while. Like, what am I going to cover? Like, what can I do that, might bring some, that I might be able to bring something extra or interesting to? And wildfire was a very obvious choice for me for a number of reasons. And that's because I have four wildfire seasons under my belt, including 3 years, three seasons with the Type 1 hand crew based out of Pocatello, the Snake River Hotshots, a BLM crew. I still got some friends on that crew. If any of them are listening, certainly a shout out. It's a hard crew with a good reputation. I'm proud of the time that I served with them. But certainly, those experiences that I had in three seasons of fire, I mean, a typical hotshot season, you do about, 1,000 base hours and about 1,000 overtime hours. You see a lot of fire. You see a lot of country. You have a lot of really crazy experiences. You make a lot of good friends. You kind of experience your physical and mental limits on a pretty regular basis. And so I had a lot of very positive experiences during that time, but I also had a lot of very complicated experiences. And, I do carry a fair bit of anger from that time, kind of specifically surrounding the sorts of dangers, both short and long term, that I and my friends and colleagues face. That comes from, the very real threat of wildfire. Like, it is obviously a sometimes quite deadly and dangerous thing, but also tree felling incidents, vehicle accidents, aviation. I mean, like, I think the dangers on the fire line are often not exactly what people are necessarily what people think of burnovers, of course, as well they should. But, heart attacks are very common on the fire line. Helicopters falling out of the sky, slips, trips, and falls. I mean, if you're on a saw team, you've got your saw, you've got your gas, you've got 40, 50 pounds of gear. I mean, you've got like 70 to 80 additional pounds on top of your bulk wandering through the woods, loose soil, loose rocks, sharp tools. I mean, it's just, you have so many elements just like waiting to cause injury. And I certainly had some close calls. I've seen some very close calls, and I've also been close to some fairly serious incidents. And so, those experiences, like both like the feelings that those experiences left me with, but also just like the things that I directly experienced. I mean, I've really kind of tried to leverage those in my reporting, but I also do try to be, having been a firefighter, that helps to some degree, that gives me some insight and advantage over others who are trying to cover these things. But I also, very much consider myself a student of fire now. Like, having done it does not make me an expert on its own, right? Like, I've had to read a lot. I'm constantly reading academic papers, speaking to some of the brightest minds in fire who have been just so gracious with their time, folks like Steve Pine and many researchers like him, just huge names being so gracious and speaking to me at length.
What do we know about, fire as a natural agent, a natural process on our landscape? Can you tell us, like, what are the basics to know about that?
I certainly want to, like, qualify everything I'm about to say by just saying full front that I I'm not an ecologist, I'm not a scientist, but certainly regularly I'm speaking with these people and reading their work and have right. some sense of kind of the, the consensus or common positions out there. And I think what you can say pretty uncomplicatedly is that many landscapes in the American West, certainly including the landscapes surrounding us right now, dry pine forests are ecosystems that are not only able to withstand regular fire, but in fact, just fully depend on it. Sometimes I sound off on blue sky. And, you know, I recently wrote something to the effect of, you know, when I hear people say that we should suppress all wildfires, I hear something akin to we should try to prevent rain from falling on the forest.
Well, isn't it the case that, you know, these ecosystems, the plants that are dominant in these ecosystems, they evolved within the conditions of having fire. And
Absolutely.
So they are, it's not like they have immunity from fire.
They are
it's
fire
that
dependent.
They are fire dependent.
Well, I think of the lodgepole pine. For that seed to crack open, it needs to have fire to move through.
Right, to melt the seed casing or whatever.
Right.
You hear a lot of language like, you know, learning to live with fire. And I think that that sort of rhetoric is useful and interesting. And I understand why it's kind of sprung up. But in one of my recent conversations with Steve Pine, who, you know, if anyone out there is interested in wildfire, Steve Pine is, he is kind of the fire historian. He's a wonderful scholar. I read his work all the time. I used to read him on the fire line. He actually kind of flips that phrase on its head. So, you know, living with fire, you'll hear that. How do we learn to live with fire better? He says that a better way to think about it is recognizing that fire is a part of life, right? That there are many fire-dependent species out there, certainly plant species like you just mentioned, but there are many plant species that have such relationships that require regular fire to basically just function, to flourish. But it's not just plant species. Like, there are many animal species that are also fire-dependent, and I very much include us, humans, as a fire-dependent species. Like, I think that humans have had a relationship with fire since we have existed as a species. Like, we, our very survival has depended on the active use of fire, both at the landscape scale and just, like, I mean, like, the hearth, like, the campfire. Like, we have had a deep, millions-year-long history with fire. We are also a fire species, though at times we often pretend like we're not or deny that essence.
So what should a healthy forest with a normal fire regime look like?
Yeah, again, you know, it's like what I'm going to be repeating here is just kind of the understanding that I've developed through my reading and research and interviews. And it's going to be different for different ecosystems. Not every single, like, there are many fire-dependent ecosystems, but that does not mean that all fire-dependent ecosystems look the same. But, you know, some that I am more familiar with, like certainly large ponderosa stands, dry pine forests, very much have adapted to the presence of quite regular burning. 5 to 15 year intervals is something that I will often hear from folks. And so what those sorts of forests will often look like when they do have that sort of scale and frequency of fire is fairly large trees with significant space between them, not a lot of smaller trees. Like, you know, the thing that I often hear is like a healthy ponderosa forest is one that you can just sprint through without a trail. Right. And I think a lot of us have probably seen forests like that. And, like, you know, there is a lot of active management going on. There are such forests that do receive the scale and frequency of fire that's necessary. And, like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure many people have seen forests like that. One of the legacies of decades and decades of fire suppression is when you're not allowing fire to regularly move through the landscape. I don't think it's terribly surprising that one of the consequences is that you get a lot of buildup of fuels, lots of smaller trees that would typically and historically have been killed by fire moving regularly through are allowed to build up. And so when the fires do ultimately come, they have a lot more fuel to play with. And it's not just the quantity of fuel. It's also kind of like the layering of fuel. In fire, we talk about ladder fuels, which are kind of like trees and shrubs and whatnot of kind of progressive heights that can allow fire to move from the ground where it is, you know, it's cleaning up duff and leaf litter, other fuel, killing smaller trees, but generally speaking, not climbing up into the bigger trees. But when you do have that sort of progressive height of trees around the larger ones, fire is much easier for fire to climb up into the crowns. And with the right sorts of circumstances, you know, wind, heat, slope, that fire can get up into the crowns and you start to see extreme fire behavior, sustained crown runs, pyrocumulus clouds, which is when fires literally will create their own weather. Like, I have been on incidents where I'm being rained on by the cloud that has been built by the fire. They can put down their own lightning, which of course starts its own fire. I mean, like, being close to extreme fire like that is one of the most extraordinary, I mean, some of the most extraordinary experiences of my life.
I bet a lot of our listeners, you know, pay attention to the news, and large fires that probably people can put a name to.
Lahaina, Los Angeles, the Marshall Fire.
Right. Mm-hmm. They feel like they are becoming more prevalent, larger in size and magnitude, more disastrous to people on the ground or their communities. Is the incidence of fire today the most it's ever been? Because it sure feels like that when I'm listening to the news, perhaps.
This is such an essential question, and it is such a complex question. It is definitely the case that we have witnessed a scale of destruction with fires that is without precedent, basically. Like the Chicago fires, literally the deadliest fire in American history was in the Midwest, I believe in Wisconsin, jumped one of the Great Lakes, killed thousands of people. Mm. But like the frequency with which we are seeing these sorts of finger of God incidents where like literally entire neighborhoods and communities, like paradise literally
right.
wiped off the face of the map. An entire community of hundreds of people literally destroyed almost in its entirety. An extraordinary event, but then one that like we almost forget about. Because now we have LA, right? We have the Marshall Fire. I think it's worth noting both of those were winter fires, right? I mean, like some of the most destructive fires in recent years have happened outside of what is typically the fire season. So you never want to not acknowledge the real loss, the real harm, the real destructiveness that has been occurring. Like that truly is extraordinary. So if you take about a century long view, it is, in fact, the case that over the last three or four decades, we have seen a steady increase in acreage burned. But I think more importantly, the destructiveness of fires, the loss of structures, the loss of life, but also in the intensity of fires, right? One of the many problems that we have when it comes to talking about wildfire is we talk about them in like very brute and I think kind of unhelpful ways. We talk about just raw acreage, like this fire burned or destroyed 120,000 acres. I don't think that's helpful at all. I think that structures destroyed is a meaningful and important metric, obviously, lives lost more so. But I think when it comes to just like overall acreage, I think it is important to kind of distinguish between the sorts of burning that's occurring. Even today, as fires have been getting more severe, when you have serious hot crown fires moving through many landscapes, that is doing very serious damage. It is nuking the soil. Soil is often a living thing. It is doing stand replacing events in ecosystems that are not accustomed to that sort of thing. Like you're really seeing many landscapes be rewritten by those sorts of fires. But even today, the vast majority of acreage in most incidents is low to moderate severity, which many will lump under the term of beneficial fire. Fire that mirrors historical norms, that is doing good ecological work, that is removing the sorts of ladder fuels we were just talking about, that is generative of the ecosystem, an essential component of the ecosystem. And so what can you say if you take that kind of shorter time frame? Yes, in the last three or four decades, we have seen acreages go up, we have seen destructiveness go up, and we've seen severity increase. But what we have been getting a better sense of in recent years, thanks to I'm gonna get the name wrong, but it's like the tree ring burn scar network. It's something to that effect.
Right.
But scientists from across the country, including Dr. Don Falk at University of Arizona, who I've spoken to in the last year or so, they've assembled a massive data set of thousands of tree rings, and not just the country, like into Canada, into Mexico, kind of like a continent level look at fire frequency and scale and extent.
Going how far back?
Literally to 1600.
Wow.
I believe you both have scientific backgrounds. I think you guys have a sense of how difficult it often is to look back in time with the different data. Tree rings are extraordinary.
Right.
With tree rings, you can actually talk about incidents in the distant past to the year and sometimes even to like the season, right? Like fires are burnt into the living record of the landscape.
Yeah, you'll see a scar in the tree ring itself.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And so using this network, we now have just an extraordinarily detailed sense of fire regimes of centuries past. And so one of the key findings from that work is one that I think like hits people and I think kind of doesn't register precisely because of what you were just talking about, like the sense that we get through media coverage and just like the very basic reality. Like we are seeing hundreds of homes be destroyed. We are seeing lives being lost. We are seeing entire shot crews being killed. Like we are seeing horrific things happening on an extraordinary basis. But when you step back and actually take this longer view that we now can with this data, some of these numbers I basically get goosebumps even thinking about when comparing even this extraordinary, I think objectively extraordinary period of burning, you know, from basically the mid 80s into the 2020s, the average annual acreage using this tree ring network compared to the nearly three century average, 1600 to 1880, almost 300 years of data, what we are burning now is just a quarter, less than a quarter of what was the historical norm. So we are talking about a fire deficit of 4 times. The amount of fire on the ground that we are experiencing now is dramatically lower than what landscapes are.
So instead of looking
to.
At scale or frequency, we should look at intensity.
That's exactly right. One of the many legacies of fire suppression, but not just fire suppression. I mean, climate change is very much playing a role here, but I just think I do sometimes think that climate change is emphasized to the exclusion of the legacy of fire suppression. They're interacting, but like, yeah, we are seeing more intense fires. But then also like the loss question isn't just a question of the increasing intensity of fires. It's also the fact that we have just been building in the wildlands as if wildfire is unnatural. And the way that I've talked about that is like, you know, people building on land that thirsts for flame. If you build on land that has historically burned, needs to burn, it will burn. And that might include your house unless you take the many measures. In some ways, it's akin to climate change in that, like, we have known how to solve climate change for decades. We've just have not had the political will, thanks to, you know, moneyed interests and powerful forces that are insistent on continuing to pump fossil carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, right? Like, we know how to solve it. We just haven't. You can build homes to withstand these fires. You can build communities with fire in mind. If you start from the position that, like, wildfire is inevitable, wildfire is necessary, you can stop these losses. And we have a history in this country. Cities used to be built of wood, and they were regularly being destroyed by these sorts of incidents. And so people were like, maybe let's not.
Let's not do it.
Maybe right. Let's stop. So it's, I mean, it's like, so, we know what to do. We're just not doing it.
So I want to talk about, you know, an alternative to suppression in a moment, but talk to us a little bit about some tangible pocketbook issues that are coming up because of severity of fires and especially how they're impacting people's structures and how that affects costs.
You know, my job allows me to speak with smart people all the time. It's one of the great privileges of being a reporter. And there's some really excellent researchers that are looking into the homeowners insurance question right now. And one of the quotes that I got from one of them has just stuck in the back of my head and has essentially been this like seed of ongoing reporting, which is homeowners insurance is where many people will first experience climate change. Some people are aware of the homeowners insurance crisis, but many think of it as isolated to California, Florida, Louisiana, and for good reason. Like, those states very much are further along the path toward what some call the uninsurable future. But the crisis has fully arrived in the West. And so reporting that I and my Mountain West News Bureau colleague Rachel Cohen and I did earlier this year looked at non-renewals, like when you get a note literally from your insurance company saying, sorry, thanks for paying your premiums for decades, but good luck finding another insurer. And also just premiums rising and what we're seeing in the West. So I focused my reporting on Boise County, which is just north of the actual city of Boise and includes places like Crouch and rural wooded. Sure. Mm-hmm. So they have seen in just a 5-year period between 2018 and 2023, they have seen their non-renewal rates nearly triple.
Wow.
In neighboring Blaine County, which includes Sun Valley, they have also nearly tripled. In Teton County, just across the border in Wyoming, they increased by literally 15
of
times.
Of not being able to get insured.
Of being booted from your policy.
Not just the
getting
rates
a letter
are
from
higher.
Your. Like, yeah. Exactly. So this is like lots of people focus on the premiums increasing, which is important.
Yeah.
What if you can't get insurance at
Period.
Any price?
Right.
The entire housing market rests on a functioning insurance market. If you hold a mortgage, your lender will insist that you have insurance. Why? Because the house is the collateral. If your collateral turns to ash, like that's...
And you won't be able to sell a house without insurance.
Like, would you buy a house that is difficult or impossible to insure? If you had one, would you want to keep it? Right? So we now have communities in Idaho and across the West that are running full force into what I think can very fairly and not hyperbolically be described as an insurance crisis. And if there's an insurance crisis, that means that there is a real estate crisis because the vast majority of us do not have $500,000 in liquid assets just sitting around waiting to buy a house. We need debt to do so. And there is no lender in the West that will give you a loan if you do not have your property insured full stop.
So there is a problem. Okay, so let's think then about recent reporting you've done about a possible way forward and a way out of a suppression first kind of model of fire.
Absolutely. You know, the tree ring data and the consensus among fire scientists is overwhelming. Like, I mean, if you talk to any fire scientist, they're going to say, we need to burn. We need to burn more. We need to burn more. We need to burn more. And they're going to say it in a very exasperated voice because it's very stressful. And so, like, how do you do that? Like, what are the ways in which we can get more beneficial fire on the ground? Prescribed fire. That's probably the form that most people are familiar with. That is the intentional burning of landscapes in very controlled situations where the escapes are very uncommon and you can just get good fire on the ground. We are doing that to some degree, not nearly enough.
Right.
Another way to do that, basically the idea that when a fire starts and the conditions are right, you know, you might do suppression tactics in some parts of the fire, but in others where it's like, do your thing. We're going to keep an eye on it. And like, if conditions change, our tactics will change, but we're going to let this fire do the good ecological work and also the good resiliency work that it's doing. So that's very promising. In the United States, not just here, but around the world, there are millennia old traditions of what is now called cultural burning, which is the deliberate use by indigenous peoples of fire for a wide range of purposes. And like, I do think that when talking about cultural burning, sometimes it'll kind of like collapse as if like all indigenous peoples use fire in the same ways. No, it's like religious ceremonies. You know, for example, the situation that I know the best is the Karuk people of Northern California. One very specific example, they use hazel for their basketry, their very famous basketry. And so they will burn hazel in certain ways. It allows it to grow in ways that are much easier to use for their basketry. The Karuk are one of a handful of tribes in the United States right now that are really pushing the boundaries of what's possible with cultural burning. And with a pair of state reforms in California, reforms around liability, but then most importantly, reforms that allowed all federally recognized tribes to enter into agreements with the state natural resources department to bypass many of the regulations around cultural burning. I was there this summer witnessing this myself. It was an extraordinary thing to see. They give a number of agencies a heads up. We're going to do this. We're going to do it here. And they just go out and they just burn. So right now they're largely limited to private parcels where they have the written consent of the landowners or on tribally controlled land. But what I saw was good structure, protection, resiliency burning being done, tribally led, tribally conducted, burning on ancestral territories. It is an absolutely inspiring example of indigenous sovereignty. And so like seeing them actually do this thing fully within the law with few hurdles to jump through, it was exceptional. We did a nice grass burn right off the Klamath. I was out there with a lighter at some points, running a hose at some points, but we were out there with teenagers that were doing summer work with the Natural Resources Department. And so like watching young Karuk kids with fire in their hands, feeling comfortable around serious fire, like learning from elders, including Bill Tripp and his brother and others who have just been major forces in cultural burning, it is one of the most inspiring things that I've ever seen in my life. And so they are at the vanguard right now. They are at the tip of the spear for efforts to bring back these practices. And I think that there's a lot of promise in that model. There are many questions that remain, but it's also a way to completely turn our relationship with fire on its head. We see fire as a threat. We see fire as out of the norm. We see fire as an unwelcome presence. The Karuk are like, no, we are a fire people. We need fire to live. And I think more people need to be paying attention to what's happening in Northern California right now.
Excellent. That's really cool. And possibly could be scaled up to other lands,
absolutely,
as you're saying, into
absolutely
other public lands.
And so, yeah, I mean, like, I do want to say, like, I mean, the Karuk are unique to some sure degree in that they have maintained a fairly unbroken tradition of burning despite repression and policy, but like they want to teach others and they are not the only people with cultural burning traditions in the United States.
So let's connect this back to our trivia question. So in what year did modern wildfire suppression start in the United States? Tell us that story.
Yeah, so I think that there are kind of two good answers, but I'm gonna start with probably the one that most people thought of, which is 1910, which is the year of, you know, the great fires of 1910, which burned millions of acres between Idaho and Montana. Quite a number of deaths. I mean, this was extreme, powerful, wind-driven, destructive fire, and it really kind of planted the seeds of a real like suppression-first mindset, which was ultimately formalized in 1935, which I would say would be kind of the other answer to this. And that is when we got a letter from the former Forest Service Chief Ferdinand Silcox, in which the 10 a.m. policy was first articulated. And that basically stated was the goal of the fire service should be to suppress any fire during the first shift, and if not during the first shift, by 10 a.m. of the following morning. That was ultimately abandoned formally, I believe, in the 1970s. But the legacy of suppression remains, and even today, like, the vast majority of wildfires are actively suppressed, and we are very much still living with the legacy, the almost entirely negative and destructive legacy of a suppression-first mindset.
Well, Murphy, we really want to thank you for joining us today. It's an especially important topic for us in the West. And for our listeners, if you want to learn more about Murphy's articles and such, please go to Mountain West News Bureau and check them out. Thank you, Murphy.
Thanks, Murphy.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.